The Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio. Hi, it's John Williams. We are downtown Chicago, and the Wintrust Business Lunch rolls on. Pete Zimmerman is your producer today. He made it downtown today, too. So we hope you're able to get about and around and do all the things you need to do. That information you just heard in the news is important, though. If your vaccination scheduled for today was going to be done by the city of Chicago, not necessarily in, but by the city of Chicago, and presumably if you're one of these people, you've already been notified, your vaccination appointment for today has been postponed. Okay. 1211 on WGN on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Let's talk about stocks. Let's talk about the markets. Let's talk about the economy a little bit. Here's John Najarian, the founder of MarketRebellion.com. Hi, John. Welcome back.
Great to be with you. Thank you very much.
What caught your eye today, my friend? What's looking good or bad? What's news in your world?
Well, these days, Bitcoin is always in the news. It traded over 50,000 today. Pulled back from there, but still is just on an incredible run, a GameStop-like run, you might say, but without the pullbacks. I mean, very little on the pullback side. Palantir, this is Peter Thiel's company that does really big data mining. They had good earnings, but the stock had performed so well into the earnings that they needed to be great, and they were not great. The conference call sounded great afterwards, but nonetheless, the stock is down 11%. So those would be two of the areas that I'd be watching today. And pot stocks are still, the must-have this year and ever since the election when both Arizona and New Jersey went positive on recreational marijuana. These stocks have been just on fire. Aphria today is up 24%. That's APHA. This is a $6 billion company. There's a host of them. Of course, last week it was all about Tilray. That one's up 15% today. Aurora Cannabis is up 9%. Canopy Growth is up 6%. Kronos is up 8%. I mean, the moves that the cannabis companies are making and shameless plug, I own an ETF that tracks a number of them called THCX. And that ETF, the cannabis ETF, is up 6% on the day with a diversified portfolio of 29 different cannabis stocks.
What about Callaway Golf? I saw that this is like, you could almost play a game. I'll give you the stock. You tell me if, because of the pandemic, it's going well for them or it's going not well for them. If you said Callaway Golf, I would have said probably pretty good. It's been an outdoor sport. People are anxious to get outside. It's automatically socially distanced. Callaway Golf would be up. I'm reading that shares of the sports equipment company fell more than 5%. So it shows you what I know.
Well, but you would have, your gut instinct would have been correct, though, because from the March lows of last year when it was $7, it is 400% higher than that right now, even with a 4% sell-off. I mean, Callaway is $28.53 as you and I are speaking right now, and that stock, your gut instinct was exactly right. Social distancing, you're out there getting some exercise, and I believe the rounds of golf, the Medina and other big courses in the Chicago area, which of course is not year-round, but nonetheless, those courses put up record numbers of starting times for 2020, and I'm sure 2021 will be the same for them. And it's great for Eli, of course, which is Callaway's stock symbol, ELY.
Oh, didn't realize any of that. By the way, you mentioned GameStop a moment ago, and I saw somewhere this morning, I don't have it in front of me, but no fewer than 6 different movies are being made about GameStop and what happened. Explain it to us. I don't know who the players are. I don't know. Normally, it's hard to tell a movie about, it's hard to make a movie about stocks and make it interesting unless you have a compelling personality, unless you have a Gordon Gekko. Who is the person that is going to, you know, sing the virtues of greed or whatever it is? You know, who's the person that a movie about GameStop would even be about?
Well, I've been contacted by two of the documentary filmmakers that are making movies about GameStop. So I don't know that I am that Gordon Gekko greed is good guy, but I do know an awful lot about what went on and what continues to go on with the Wall Street Bets crowd, which, by the way, beginning of this year, that's a subreddit, and it's Wall Street Bets, plural. That crowd was 2 million people, John, in the beginning of this year. It is now 9 million strong. So when you get that many investors that are focused on just a handful of stocks, yeah, they can move those stocks. Now, do they move Apple and Microsoft? Not really, because we're talking about billion share offerings at those companies. I mean, the shares outstanding are measured in the billions. But when you're talking about a relatively small offering like Tilray or like GameStop, both of which were part of the Wall Street Bets crowd, you can move those stocks against even the biggest whales or hedge funds on Wall Street.
I didn't realize they'd reached out to you. Who's going to play you in the movie? I presume Brad Pitt?
I wish. It more likely it'd be the overweight version of Steven Seagal. But nonetheless, I'm talking about documentaries. I don't know if it'll end up being a feature film with Steve Carell and those guys,
yeah, exactly.
Christian Bale, like they did with The Big Short.
Jordan Bernfield's going to update us on some other numbers now, so I'm going to let you go. We'll visit again, okay?
Thank you, sir. Thanks. You have a great one.
That's John Najarian, founder of MarketRebellion.com. Greg McBride is our guest again, chief financial analyst at Bankrate.com. Welcome back, Greg. Good to have you on.
Thanks, John. Great to be with you.
I'm looking at one of your reports. 54% of Americans say they have more emergency savings than credit card debt. This has been an interesting kind of double-edged sword that we've been following the last several months on the Business Lunch. People actually are saving more. Their debt's gone down. The problem is, I guess, we'd like to see people spending to spur the economy at the same time, right?
Well, it's this sort of paradox of thrift, right? If people are saving, that means they're not spending. But, listen, I think we have to take the long view in that, the money that's saved today is going to sustain a level of spending down the road. And it's also the money that somebody might use to start a business or, something like that at some point in the future that, has the potential to provide some real, economic oomph, even if it doesn't give us that immediate gratification.
What else is your reporting saying? What else jumps out at you?
Well, you noted that a little bit more than half have more emergency savings and credit card debt. And as counterintuitive as it may seem, that's actually improved over the course of the last 12 months. Nothing like a bad economy to get people to motivate them to save. We also see an increase in how people are prioritizing savings relative to debt. More people now prioritizing boosting that savings than paying down credit card debt. It's not an either or proposition. You can and should focus on doing both of these at the same time. But very clear that, people are emphasizing one over the other. Only about 1 in 8 say they're actually working on both at the same time.
Yeah, well, lucky them. But if you had your druthers, if you only did one, you would pay off an 18% card rather than keeping it in a bank that doesn't draw any interest, right? The math, I understand the sort of sense of security you have by having more money in your bank account, say, but the math is definitely on the other side, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm always amazed by the people that are carrying credit card debt and then say, yeah, but I don't want deplete my savings and pay it off. Part of the root of that problem is successful saving is all about the habit. If you're in the habit, say through a direct deposit from your paycheck into a savings account, of regularly feeding that savings account, then you can have a little more comfort in using it to pay off that credit card debt. But if you've never been a good saver, if paying off the credit card debt is just going to leave you in a position where you've got no savings and then you're still out spending and racking up the debt again, that's just going to dig the hole even deeper.
Did you look at the demographics on that? Is everybody doing the same thing or does it break out in certain ways?
We see this breaking out in a way, you know, not unlike the pandemic itself, which, as we've seen, John, has had a more pronounced impact on younger and lower income households. And we see the same here, younger and lower income households least likely to have emergency savings that exceeds credit card debt, more likely to be the reverse, where they've got debt that exceeds their savings, a reflection of the fact, too, that credit card debt can appear suddenly and takes a long time to pay down, whereas emergency savings takes a long time to build up, and it can disappear very quickly.
Some debt is good, though, right? I mean, if it's a mortgage, people don't look at that as bad debt. How do you know the difference between good and bad debt?
Well, part of it is, you know, are you using debt for consumption? Yeah, that's why credit card debt is considered bad debt, because you're using that to pay for something from yesterday. The mortgage, as you noted, good debt. Within reason, federal student loans, also good debt. You don't want to go six figures into debt to, you know, get an archaeology degree necessarily, but, you know, the average graduate comes out $30,000 in debt. You've got a marketable degree. You know, that's a low interest rate debt that you can pay over time that's been an investment in your future earning power. So, you know, the distinction between good debt and bad debt, some of it revolves around interest rate. A lot of it revolves around what are you using this debt for? Is it something that appreciates? Is it an investment in yourself? Or is it paying for the consumption of yesterday?
Well, obviously cars, trucks, and vans depreciate as you drive them off the lot, but yet that's the way you do make a living. What do you say about car loans?
I think a lot of people go overboard with that. I mean, you look at the average amount financed on new car right now is $34,000. With tight household budgets, you know, the budget buster is often what's sitting in the driveway. Look at lightly owned used vehicles. A lot of times vehicles will lose half their value in the first 3, 4, 5 years. Buy it at that point. You can get it a lot cheaper, less of a debt burden, and you can still get years and years of use out of it.
I guess it's been a while since I bought a car. The average car loan is $34K?
Yes, for new vehicles. Yep, exactly. We've seen a big emphasis on and growth in SUVs and trucks, and that certainly drives that up. But when you see an amount like that, it's really no surprise that we see people stretching those loan terms into 6 and 7 year loan terms in order to make those payments affordable. And all of which I think is a sign that you're spreading yourself too thin financially.
Yeah, I guess so. This is not why I asked, but or we asked you to come on today. But I think some people say, well, if it's 72 months and the monthlies are low enough, what do I care? I can get a really nice car and I can afford the monthlies. Is that a viable strategy in your mind?
People use that as a strategy and the justification, but no, because what happens, the longer you stretch that loan term, the loan balance comes down at a slower pace. The value of the vehicle does not. The value of the vehicle depreciates at the same rate, whether you've got a shorter loan or a longer loan. And the longer you've stretched out that loan term, the more you're going to be upside down, owing more than it's worth. Put you in a tough spot if, for example, a vehicle gets totaled in an accident or stolen. Yeah. If you owe more than it's worth, it leaves you in a bind.
Do you have this number handy? How much credit card debt are most people carrying? What's the balance?
The median is around $3,500 ish. The average is higher because some households,
sure,
really have $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 in debt. The average is about $5,600.
$5,600 is the average. But, yeah, I think the median might be a better number for us these days. You said $3,400?
Yeah, about $3,400, $3,500 is something in that neighborhood.
And is that for total credit card debt, or does that include store cards? I guess that's what I'm asking. Does it include all of your plastic?
Yes, that's all of the plastic, including retail cards.
And one last question. What's on a store card, what's a reasonable number for me expect to have to pay at Macy's or Nordstrom or wherever?
Oh, the interest rates generally are not reasonable. You're going to pay high teens, low 20s, and they come with small credit lines. So I think where those are advantageous is you're getting a same-day discount that pays for itself, and you're not going to use this as a crutch to buy stuff you can't afford and then pay it off at very high rates over time.
Greg McBride is the chief financial analyst, Bankrate.com. Another survey out of interesting results. Always nice to talk to you, Greg. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks a lot, John. Appreciate it.
Just looking at some of the stories that they've been reporting at ChicagoEno.com, they just make your head turn today. Here to talk about them a little bit is Jim Dahlke, senior editor at ChicagoEno. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Hey, John. Great to be here.
Let's start with the Catherine Davis story at ChicagoEno, and that is Chicago startup Ivy is doing what? Tell us that story.
Yeah, so Ivy, really interesting company in Chicago, really operating in the ride-sharing space. And, you know, what they're trying to do is kind of really elevate the experience of riding in an Uber or a Lyft. And so what they're doing is providing tablets, video screens to Uber rides, Lyft rides, and also massaging capabilities. So working with a kind of cushion maker to create essentially in Uber massages for your next ride. So what they're doing is sort of piloting this down in Miami currently, working with individual Uber and Lyft drivers. But their goal is to roll this out kind of more broadly with a larger partnership with a ride hailing company. Really, the goal is to kind of really elevate the experience, right? Think about an hour-long ride from the airport to your house, right? You can envision a lot of different experiences other than just looking at your phone. So what they're doing is allowing these cabs to have access to Netflix and different viewing experiences and eventually kind of like a full haptic experience with massage capabilities. So what I like about this is that, you know, it really kind of looks at not just what the future of ride hailing can be, but even beyond that, in a driverless future, I mean, what are you going to do in your car when you don't need to have your foot on the gas or your hands on the wheel? So I'm thinking about a lot of these things in terms of the future of mobility.
Although in this case, it is for a Uber with a driver, not a driverless Uber. But and the massage would be mechanical. It wouldn't be a masseuse per se.
No, so this is happening all in the seat, right? So this is using cushions. Parts of it are kind of the massage element, but also, you know, using kind of the interactive elements of this sort of haptic feedback. So where you're watching something on Netflix and, you know, if something spooky comes out from around the corner, it can provide some pressure on the left side of your shoulder, for example. So working on different kinds of things like that.
Wow. A sushi bar would kill him. I mean, how about some craft cocktails while we're sitting back there? Maybe that's not far off. This startup uses documentaries to help companies build a more inclusive culture. What are you talking about?
Yeah, so, you know, every company is familiar with those, you know, old dusty VHS tapes that you plug in when somebody first starts a job to learn about workplace harassment, sexism in the workplace, all the kind of things that you want to get across to your employees early on about building your company culture and treating your employees right. And really what this startup does is called Storybolt, here based in Chicago. It's really kind of flipped that on its head and really done a really interesting way to kind of revamp, you know, the way employers teach their employees about company culture and their values. So what Storybolt does is it connects companies with a library of 4,000 documentary films where it educates employees about diversity and equity and inclusion, mental health, implicit bias, racial injustice, all kinds of different topics like that. But connecting them with rich storytelling through these documentary films, followed by a Q&A with the filmmaker themselves. So this startup really realized that, you know, when you are able to connect folks with these filmmakers who have kind of made these really, really immersive, wonderful documentaries, it's really able to drive the point home. And so they've really taken off. They've worked with companies including Amazon and Google and Paylocity, and really kind of connecting with these large enterprises to bring these documentary films to their employees and really drive the point home and really elevate the experience of learning about different workplace issues.
What's Zillow up to these days? I see there's a Chicago angle here.
Yeah, Zillow just acquired a company in Chicago last week called Showing Time, based in Chicago here, founded in 1999. They pioneered online scheduling for residential real estate. Essentially, they developed an online scheduling platform for home showings, and just last week was acquired for $500 million. So pretty significant Chicago tech exit by Zillow.
Wow. Just once, every now and then you blow me away with a number, right? $500 million. $500 million for a company that's 20 years old in Chicago. That's amazing to me.
It really is. And you think about Chicago, you know, as an up-and-coming tech city, right, maybe doesn't have quite a bit the momentum as some of these other markets do. But then you find this, you know, Showing Time, which quite frankly was a company I hadn't even heard of until last week. Meanwhile, acquired for $500 million. So pretty significant exit in Chicago, and a really great kind of story of that Chicago kind of has these sort of legacy tech companies that maybe you're not familiar with, but certainly the industry players are, and a company like Zillow comes calling, that's a big deal for Chicago.
Is there a brain drain when that happens? I mean, what happens to the people that were doing that in this city then?
Yeah, so Zillow says that they're going to continue to invest in Showing Time. They're going to continue to have it as a standalone brand and property within its larger company. So I don't think that there's going to be a brain drain here. It seems like the company will continue to be based here and their employees will continue to be here. You know, Zillow is really doing a lot in the home buying space itself through the Zillow offer platform. So, you know, Zillow is not just for kind of browsing passively on the internet about what homes are available. It's really kind of getting into the home buying space as well. So you imagine that this type of technology will only kind of help improve that product. But yeah, in terms of brain drain, it doesn't seem to be a problem in this instance.
One more company. Talk about Reapply.
Yeah, so this is a company in Chicago, Reapply, a really interesting business. They're in what they're calling the circular economy, which is a term used when describing an economic system that works to maximize the use of resources and eliminate waste. So they kind of help large businesses sort of exchange goods and eliminate waste and recycle more. And what they just did today was raise $8 million, led by an Indianapolis-based VC firm, High Alpha. Pretty significant funding for a number of reasons, but this startup is led by Gary Cooper in his $8 million raise. In the 7 or so years we've been covering tech, this is one of the largest venture funding rounds we've seen led by a Black founder in Chicago. So really significant funding for the city of Chicago and for founders of color.
Reapply, it looks like, I like the way I pronounced it, Reapply, because it's sort of repurposing things, but it's R-H-E-A-P-L-Y, Reapply, correct?
That's right.
All right. It's good to talk to you again. Thanks for joining us, Jim. We'll visit again next week.
Sounds good, John. Thanks so much.
Jim Dahlke is the senior editor at ChicagoInno.com. We keep rolling now on the Wintrust Business Lunch with more business news from Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago-based Nature's Find has released its first products online. The vegan products are neither plant nor animal-based. They're made from a microbe in the fungi kingdom found in a Yellowstone National Park hot spring. The company's first offerings are original dairy-free cream cheese and original meatless breakfast patties. They sold out almost immediately after going on sale. Nature's Find plans to have its products more broadly available later this year. Chicago startup Pluie, creator of a self-sanitizing diaper-changing table that uses UV light to disinfect the table's surface, has installed its first unit in the pediatric wing of Angel Harvey Family Health Center in Chicago. The company plans to eventually expand to Chicago restaurants, parks, retail, and other facilities before launching in new cities. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Yes, it's my turn to talk on the radio. It's 12:51 on WGN. I'm sorry that I was a little distracted. I was looking at the line that is queuing up outside the place to get the vaccine in Joliet. Figures that today is the day. It's 1,000 degrees below zero, and there's a new foot of snow on the ground, and it is my 88-year-old's mom's turn to stand in the line. But that's the way they're doing it. I think she's going to get it. But enough about me. Amy Guth joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Hi, Amy.
Hi, John.
There's a little personal tragedy going on there. No, not tragedy. This is good news. She is going to get the vaccine today, and that's the main thing. So let's talk.
Yeah, my mom just got hers last week. Yeah.
Oh, no kidding. In what town or county, if you don't mind?
She lives in Chattanooga. So she got hers and she says she's feeling good.
Yeah. Amen to that. Let's talk a little bit about the weather and how it's affecting people, not just your folks or my folks. Let's talk about what's happening with auto production. I guess more resources are being diverted to heating people's homes. So some plants have had to temporarily shut down.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Ford is shuttering a Kansas City assembly plant, which is a very big one for them. They that particular plant makes the Ford F-150 pickup, which is one of their biggest selling vehicles. And that's due to a natural gas shortage caused by this severe weather that's come through the country. Now, when you think of, you know, they're looking at maybe a week, a little bit longer, something like that, to have this closure. That might seem minor, but when you start looking at that on their books, when Ford has already had a lot of issues this year with due to the microchip shortage, they said earlier this month that they expect to lose 10 to 20% of their planned first quarter production. That was before this closure, so they were already kind of bracing themselves. And that 10 to 20% margin could translate to between a $1 billion and $2.5 billion loss in earnings for the year. So even a week closure can be a very big deal when we're kind of looking at the bottom line for this company. For consumers, that, of course, means delayed delivery. So there could also be a little bit later down the pipeline, you might have trouble finding the vehicle or finding parts for your vehicle if you already have an F-150. So it's interesting to watch how this trickles out and how this weather is impacting so many different areas of business and this company in particular.
Is that their best-selling vehicle? I think the F-150 might be, right?
It is. Yeah, it sure is. It sure is. And a couple of other plants have been closing for weather, not related to the natural gas shortage, they say. They said it was all entirely weather. GM confirmed that they canceled several shifts this week. Stellantis, which is the new name of Fiat Chrysler, I'm still not even used to calling it that. They said they shut down a Toledo, Ohio assembly plant also due to weather. So we very well may see, like, later in the pipeline, later in the year, some lower production, some shortage of auto delivery for dealers and things like that.
Talk to me about pot sales. I know Steve referenced it earlier, but weed stock is doing well, right?
Yeah, there's kind of two pieces of this story that I think are interesting. And so the co-founder of Cresco Labs, which is one of the biggest marijuana companies in Chicago, he Joe Contalbiano, he is creating this company. It's kind of one of the blank check companies we've been hearing a lot about lately. His plan is he's going to kind of roll up a bunch of smaller companies and consolidate them so they can be a more, you know, a lean operation and use each other's resources and things like that. He initially, from his first regulatory filing, said $100 million. He's raised that to $150 million in his stock offering. He's not going to go public in the U.S. because it's still not federally legal. You can't do that here yet, but in Canada, you can. So that makes the fourth Chicago company to go public if he pulls this off. And, you know, I think a lot of industry observers have been talking a lot about how, you know, the activity in Chicago and how Chicago is really making a name for itself in the marijuana industry. But this is a very big move. The company he's creating is called Choice Consolidation. And as more states are looking at legalizing recreational marijuana, a company like that can give a lot of resources and buy out these smaller companies in other states could potentially be very, very valuable. So I'll be watching that one very closely, too.
Right on the Canadian market. I didn't even know this, that all of these companies worth whatever they're worth are not publicly traded. They can't be in the United States.
Yeah, that's right. So as long as marijuana is not federally legal, you can't do that. So there's a lot of push between or among executives and leadership in marijuana companies, because it's not just about going public. There's access to banking kind of issues that if you're moving money over state lines and moving federal money, there's kind of some, you know, some issues there. So it's very hard for a startup to, say, get funding, to get a bank, to, you know, do things that any company can do. So a lot of companies are really trying to push for legislation to get access to those kind of things that would eventually hopefully lead to, you know, more the ability to go out on the public market here in the U.S. as well. I think that will be really fascinating when that happens. As more states have been moving towards that, I'm sure it's eventually going to happen, but watching companies maneuver around it has been right. Really, really interesting. And a lot of them really leaning on the Canadian Stock Exchange for that.
Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Okay, Amy, we'll visit again. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much, John.